The World Saxophone Quartet performing Lamiot Blewett's I Heard That. I'm sorry you didn't hear me. We're opening up the program. I'm having technical difficulties on my end, it seems, with our connection. It's from the 1989 album Rhythm and Blues. Julius Hemphill and Oliver Lake, both on alto sax, David Murray on tenor, and Lamiot Blewett himself on baritone sax. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Monday, August the 17th, 2015. And not so well publicized at all outside of the state of Michigan. Last Thursday, Wayne County, the home county of the city of Detroit, tactically avoided declaring bankruptcy. But just like the once vibrant Motor City, the county's fiscal future is far from sound and certainly far from settled. 8 months after a federal judge approved a contentious state-imposed bankruptcy plan to discharge an estimated $20 billion in debt, the Wayne County Commission voted 14-1 last Thursday to accept a consent agreement with the state, giving it direct authority, giving the state direct authority to call the shots on drastic cuts the county is expected to make to fund an annual $52 million debt. Tom Barrow, an expert in municipal finance, a former chairman of Michigan's Board of Accountancy, and president of Citizens for Detroit's Future, joins us now to help dissect the rippling effect of Detroit's bankruptcy. And I thank you so much, Mr. Barrow, for being with us today.
To be here and to share some time with you and your listeners.
Thank you so much. Well, let's start with this. Immediately we see that the city's fiscal problems, that's the city of Detroit, has now transferred to the county level. What do you make of what has happened last Thursday?
Well, you know, I think from the outside, that may be how it may appear. It may appear that because of what the financial problems that the city just endured, that then it is causing a rippling effect onto the county. But in fact, the county operates completely independent of the city. Part of its debt structure does not include the city of Detroit, per se. In fact, its debts are solely its debts and are a result of the running of the county. But I think to the outside world, the impression that this is going to give, and it's a false impression, is that this appears to be another instance of blacks not being able to run. Because, of course, as you know, the county executive now is black. But this is the first black county executive in probably a couple decades or so. So it is not a result of his own activities and his own actions. And it has nothing to do with the city of Detroit. It's happening on its own. But I am not convinced, and I think to many who are around here, what this is all about, in my opinion, it's these conservatives, and there are conservative Democrats. You know, they used to call them years ago the blue dog kind of Democrats. But there are conservative Democrats who kind of buy into let's change the pension system. Let's renege on the pension promise, and that's what this is overwhelmingly about. It's to get to the pensioners and to make them buckle and to make them now give up part of the promise that they had, despite it being guaranteed under the state's constitution. It's an incredible move, but they did it anyhow. In Detroit, and so that's what this is all about. And the consent agreement, of course, as you know, and many of your listeners will know, that this is just the first step. It's exactly what Dave Bing did, which ultimately led to the bankruptcy of the city, because once the consent agreement is violated, which it will likely be in this case, it will lead to a default, and of course that will mean that it will go to a bankruptcy, and then you will see the privatization of the largest county in the state of Michigan. You'll see the privatization of all of its services, buckling of the pensioners, and so on and so forth. So I'm not convinced that this was the proper first step. I'm just not. And I happen to believe that the proper first step really is to go to all the stakeholders and to try to work something out in a strong hand. And that's how I think, that's what I think failed here in Detroit. There was just no respect by those stakeholders as to what would happen because there was no credibility.
Well, what links the two, and I take your point about the that we should be very careful not to link the forced bankruptcy of Detroit to what has developed now, but we can link it in the sense that the role of the state has remained really important here, in that the state technically is now in charge of two cities, entities, the city and the county, both predominantly African American, and the state will be calling the shots, and calling the shots without a democratic process in play. And this is a very interesting concern, because this is literally a takeover, but it doesn't have the jarring effect of the word takeover in that sense.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. What this is, and you pointed out the two things that do link it. First, people need to understand that the basis upon which this consent agreement is entered into is a statute or a law called Public Act 436. It's a law that effectively was created by the conservative Republican legislature in both the House and the Senate, and the conservative Republican governor, which essentially said that cities that are in distress, these are the points and things that constitute distress, and it gives them some steps that you can do, which ultimately leads to the takeover of that city by the state and the ousting of your democratically elected officials. Well, the problem there is, Utris, is that preceding this was Public Act 10, and the people of the state of Michigan rose up against it, saying that we don't want unelected officials running our city and our states and our cities and our counties and the like. And so they circulated hundreds of thousands of petitions in an initiative which prohibited the state of Michigan from doing that and amending the Constitution to prevent it, so that this would not wind up happening. And what the conservatives did, and really people need to understand that there is a linkage here. between the faceless people that you don't see, the corporations in the form of the Mackinac Policy Center and the American Legislative Exchange Council, called ALEC, and the like, because they're the ones who are drafting these laws. Well, the people then circulated this and repealed that Public Act 10. And would you believe it, just 14 days later, the conservatives then drafted a new one, despite the people just saying we don't want it at all. They just ignored that, drafted a new one, and then put it in place and made it initiative proof, so you couldn't repeal it, and you could not offset it. So as a result, the state now gets an opportunity to take over virtually every black urban center in this state, majority black urban center in this state. Wayne County is the largest county in this state. It is heavily Democratic, overwhelmingly Democratic. It selects typically who's going to be the next governor. It selects typically who's going to be the next United States senator. And inside and embedded in Wayne County, of course, is Detroit, which is, again, a large black populated city. Well, effectively, this means that the conservatives and the other party, the Republican Party, effectively takes it over, because what's going to wind up happening here, you will now control two large urban centers, the two largest in the state and amongst the largest in the country. So that you now, when you privatize the services, like in Detroit, I mean, everything has been privatized, leading to massive amounts of debt being foisted upon the people of Detroit after we just came out of bankruptcy. We're incurring massive amounts of debt as they transfer the assets into these authorities who have no credit, who have no assets, and who essentially it's just the city running under a different set of facts and circumstances, but not controlled by the city. It's controlled now by that same conservatives who created these laws designed to transfer those assets. So I think you hit the nail on the head. That's what it's really, in my view, that's what it's about. And I think you can see it across the state. Every black urban center has been taken over effectively.
Yes. Now, this Wayne County, the takeover, essentially, of Wayne County, is the latest move. But cities like Allen Park, Benton Harbor, Ecorse, Flint, Pontiac, and two school districts, I understand, also already under direct state supervision, and this is a Republican administration. What is there no other group that is no other locality that is underperforming or in distress financially? And let me back up a bit and ask, to your mind, is bankruptcy and this forced consent agreement the only route for resolving fiscal matters in Wayne County?
I don't believe so. I think the problem in the county is a lack of confidence in the management and the leadership. I think that's where it is. I think what has to happen here, look, at the debt for the county is only $56 million, and I think you said 52, and it's either 52, 56, right in through there. That deficit has been there. That didn't just come up. The implication of people sitting out and watching this and listening to this, you'd get the impression that this just happened in the last year or so as the blacks took over, so to speak. But in fact, the deficit has been looming and has been sitting there for years and years and years and years. But you didn't have a black executive. You didn't have blacks in control. Now you do. And so now it's being foisted, and some folks will like to say, well, you know, look, they got financial, they just handled their business, they wouldn't be in this situation. But you know what? This is not unique to just this county. There are others around the state that have this problem. It is only in this instance, in those that are predominantly minority and African-American or black-controlled, do we find ourselves going down this road. And this is ultimately, and I would be astonished if it did not lead to a bankruptcy. I just don't see how it's not going to do it, because they're going to force them. They're going to provide the oversight, which again will be these conservatives who are providing the oversight, who effectively will be in charge, and it's going to push them right into that rank. And I think it was just this just made no sense to invite the devil in. I just don't see it. I think you go to your, and now what you're going to find, in my view, is the transfer of the wealth of the county. You're going to find the services of the county are going to be privatized. Who's going to get it? Those very same corporations who are the people who donate to the Republican Party and who create and foster the ALEC kind of legislative initiatives. That's where it's going to ultimately go, and you're going to find that blacks and other minorities are going to be negatively impacted as they lose their job, as their pensions are cut, as they now can no longer afford their homes, as they are then forced to become renters, as their homes are left, and then it's going to foster this whole new moving into the city, into the county, of a group of folks coming in, because now everything's going to be at a fire sale. So, I mean, that's how I see this, Idris, and I think we're seeing it played out very well in Detroit.
So we can make the case, I think, that the issue of debt, or the supposed or a contrived issue of debt, which has been your point all along, that Detroit should not have been forced into bankruptcy. It had been paying its bills, even though the market, of course, had suffered a terrible downturn because of the motor industry. But the issue of debt now is being used politically and strategically so, it would seem, to systematically empty prize black predominantly African-American cities. I mean, in Detroit alone, appointing an emergency manager in Detroit placed, according to the Census Bureau, about 49% of the African-American population of the entire state under his direct control. So this is a very, very serious political move.
There's no question. There's no question that it is, and if anybody thinks that this is not motivated by that, I think they're just unwilling to accept the reality of what they're seeing going on around them. Look, long-term debt, it's a fundamental principle that debt alone cannot cause a bankruptcy. It should not just debt alone, and long-term debt, particularly in the fashion in which it is. Let's take Detroit, for example. You know, we went into bankruptcy for the purpose of eliminating debt. And that was because people could understand debt, you know. Well, gee whiz, if you owe $100 and you don't make but $20, well, then you can never pay that $100. You just don't have the $100. Well, the $100 is not due now. The $100 is not due for 40, 50, 60 years, and it's due in increments, just like your home mortgage. Well, the point that I'm making, Utris, is that now, what they did is they took this opportunity, for example, to begin to privatize literally everything, transfer every asset using that false premise out from under the control of the city, which is perceived as African American or perceived as black, into the hands of private authorities, into the hands of the state. For example, our Belle Isle Park, which is the largest municipal park in the country, even bigger than Central Park, in New York, was now transferred to the state. Now, it was done under the guise of, well, we're going to save the city money. Well, you know, the reality is it doesn't save us any money. What it does, effectively, is the city, everything that's going on, the city could have done itself, but they had to create an impression of blacks running stuff into the ground, being incompetent and incapable, and as a result, and made it appear as if Belle Isle was dirty and you need to clean it up. And then, of course, with the media repeating that and selling that, then pretty soon people who don't know themselves will just say it and repeat it. And if they happen to have gone out there on a day when the park was just finished being used the night before and hadn't been cleaned up yet by the city in the morning, although it'll be pristine later that day, they then create that perception. Well, now that you've transferred that asset, then you turn around and you transfer now. The next asset is you talk about the lighting system. Well, they transfer everything into an authority who has no credit. So if they have no credit, how are you going to buy the lights necessary to do what you need to do? Well, the city has to really buy the lights, but the city's not controlling it. It's controlled by an authority, but the debt is on the city. The water department, they just transferred Detroit's water department, which has forever been owned by the people of the city of Detroit, And yeah, they'll say, well, we're leasing it for 100 years. And well, leasing it for 100 years effectively means you own it. We no longer own it. You're controlling it. And then they set up an authority to run the water department. And they pay you, city, $50 million a year, but that's just to pay the interest on the debt that they ran up, that they're leaving there under your name. So they're not giving you anything for this multi-billion dollar asset. And you're seeing this in every single instance in the urban centers, in cities that are controlled by blacks, Idris. So I really reject this whole false premise of that this is because of the debt. They've got something else in mind, and that is to break the backs of the pensioners. And you're going to see that in Wayne County. I guarantee you, you will see that and hear that discussion in Wayne County. They're asking pensioners to take a cut, change their health care, reduce their benefits. And these are people who have been working for their lives and worked under a promise that's now going to be reneged upon.
Other than you, because you have been a consistent critic of this entire process, who in government, surely there must be somebody, some person in the capacity of, let's say, an attorney general or an inspector general, who would say, look, this isn't smelling right. This is not the way it's supposed to be, and it is in direct contravention of so-called democratic principles, because in these matters involving taxpayer money, in these matters involving impact on citizens who are also taxpayers, one would imagine even a special referendum would be required to approve these measures. But again, this goes back to that law that the state instituted and then ramped up again to give itself even more power. But just the same, is there no body of an official capacity who has said, this process needs to be investigated? We are seeing here not just debt, the question of debt and managing debt. Everybody has debts. I mean, everybody.
Utris, I think.
I'm wondering, why is it that we're not hearing anybody say, let's do a review of this process to see whether it's actually moving along democratic principles?
As you're aware, Utris, they took over the Detroit public school system in the same manner. They've effectively privatized public education, created a myriad of charter schools, and then transferred a number of students that were still members of the remaining Detroit school system into an educational achievement authority, which of course is not a creation under the Michigan Constitution. So it has to be funded effectively vicariously through the school system. But you raised the point, and you're absolutely right, that who's watching out? How are they able to do these things? Seems to me that these things should be violative of some law. And about a week ago, the Detroit Public School Board, who effectively has been denuded of any power, despite them being required under the Constitution, and despite them holding office, they don't even give them money to meet. They don't even give them even the secretary that they let them use, it doesn't do what they say. They're responsive to somebody else. Well, they filed a Title VI complaint to the United States Civil Rights Department and Justice Department, alleging what you just described. You know, there's a discrimination going on here on the basis of color. Black kids are now being effectively ignored. They're not receiving a education as guaranteed to them and the likes. But you also touched on another point, Utris, and that is, it says that, gee whiz, it seems like there would be some referendum or something before you would sell or transfer these assets or something. And in fact, it's required. The charter requires it. But you see, here's what the problem is that the people who should be saying something about this and who should be making that happen, I gotta believe, Utris, they're just scared. They're just scared. And they're not saying it. To transfer that water department for 100 years under the Detroit City Charter, it makes it clear you can't transfer that kind of an asset without the approval of the people of the city of Detroit via a referendum. It requires that. But what they say instead is, well, look, we're not really selling it. we're leasing it, and therefore it's okay. Well, you know, you lease something for 100 years, effectively you've gotten rid of it. It's gone. It's sold. That's a little technicality that they use, and because no one is strong enough to stand up and to say that this is what you're doing is absolutely wrong and violative of the city charter, they're able to get away with it. The same is true in literally every instance. They just violate the rule, and there's no one that holds them accountable, no city official, because they're afraid, in my opinion, if I had to say, I think they're afraid of being attacked by the conservative media and by others who would then assault them and to try to prevent them from being able to hold that position in the future. What Detroit needs, in my opinion, is people holding office who don't need a job, who are there for the right reason. Not that you need a job and you need that income. That makes a huge difference. That's my view.
You're president of the Citizens for Detroit's Future. What is the current tactic that the organization is using to insert itself in the fight?
Well, what we did, frankly, Utris, and we've had a lot of concerns about Detroit's electoral system. We've seen a lot of things. I've seen a lot of things, and I sat dormant, but I know that hundreds of us have seen it. When we go and do recounts, and I don't think it's any secret that I've sought office before, and we've done a recount because we were astonished at the results when polling and everything we had should have shown one outcome, and it's an entirely 180-degree different outcome. So we look at these boxes and we do a recount, and it turns out, particularly, for example, when Dave Bing was elected, and he started this whole juggernaut towards the bankruptcy. Without Dave Bing being the mayor, who was clearly, clearly inept, incapable, his business was going through bankruptcy right at the time that it was all going on, kept very quiet. Without him being there, there would be no Detroit bankruptcy, and this entire region would be different. Well, they needed Dave Bing. But when we did the recount, 54% of the vote could not be recounted because the seals on the cases had been changed. So what did Citizens for Detroit's Future do? We know what they're doing. And I'm unabashed about this because I've seen it. And while folks may attack the messenger, I've seen it. Hundreds of us have seen the seals being changed, not matching. Hundreds of us have seen empty boxes being brought forward. And it's just being kept quiet by the media. So we then created an initiative which would require that the results of every election in the city be immediately posted right at 8 o'clock. As soon as the polls close, you must post the election results on the front door of every precinct in the city where there's voting that's taken place in that building. The same is true where the absentees are counted. That would mean that by a quarter after 8, because in Detroit, you know, you never know who won the election until the next morning around 5:30, 6, 7 o'clock the next morning. That shouldn't be. And it's because of what we're discovering during the course of the recounts. The cases are being reentered. It's astonishing to people because they think that, geez, this is America. It could not happen. The FBI would be in here and everybody would be investigating. That's because we so strongly want to believe, but it's not like that. So we then circulated the petitions. We got the signatures. We submitted them. A week and a half ago, it was the city council or the city's law department said that our initiative was, in fact, legal, and it did not violate the state constitution, did not violate state election laws, and did not violate federal election laws. And then city council ordered that the ordinance be created and then voted on the first week in September. That's what we've done. If that goes into place, I think people will begin to react differently because then they will be afraid of the electorate. Right now, they're not afraid of the electorate. They're afraid of the media. The media lambasting them and embarrassing them and humiliating them. That's what they're afraid of. And I think we've seen that in a number of our elected officials being embarrassed recently by the media attacks. So I think this is one of the huge ways that we're going to impact this entire system. And I think it'll make a difference.
Well, let's hope so, because the writing is on the wall, and we're seeing this move from a place of just theoretical discussion to actual application and with devastating effect. But thank you so much for bringing this to light to us today and explaining some of the backdrop to it. We will return, of course, to the subject and expand a bit more on it as we follow developments in these cities and in the school districts and generally in the city of Detroit. Thank you so much, Tom Barrow, for being with us today.
Beatrice, I'm delighted to have been able to spend some time, and I look forward to talking to you again. And I want everybody to understand that there is going to be a new Detroit, and it's just a matter of time before the people take back control.
Thank you. Well, I tell you, I mean, it is so clear to me that a whole different agenda is being put in, not just being put into place, but actually enforced after being put into place. And we're seeing unfolding before our very eyes how this takeover is going. It's race-based, and nobody could deny that. But it is also not just about African Americans. It is about working people, too. Poor people, working class people. And this is how the system, I talk about systems, this is how the system works. And the question is, what is our counter system? What is our counteraction going to be? Well, Julian Bond, a stalwart soldier in the continuing struggle for freedom and equality in the United States, as you know, died in Fort Walton Beach, Florida on Saturday, August the 15th. He was 75 years old. Much has been said and will be said about Julian Bond, but it is important sometimes to hear what a person is or who a person is by what that person says, what dominates in that person's mind as important to him or her. Here is Julian Bond speaking at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, discussing what creates change. And what creates change, he said, is ordinary women and men proving that they can perform extraordinary tasks in pursuit of freedom. I just want to share this with you today as we remember Julian Bond.
You know, when I get these invitations, I'm often wondered why me? Why have they invited me to come here? And I think probably the reason is because the people here knew of my close and intimate friendship with the major figure of the civil rights movement, the late Dr. Martin Luther King. And if you don't know about it, I'm going to tell you about it right now. I'm one of the eight people in the world who can honestly claim to have been a student of Dr. King. Dr. King only taught one time, only taught one class, only eight people in the class. I'm one of the eight. And so when you hear someone, and you will, say, I was a student of Dr. King's, if that person wasn't one of the eight, they're telling a tremendous lie. Well, this happened in Morehouse College, where I was a student, and Dr. King had been a student, and he taught or co-taught this class with the man who had taught him philosophy, a class in a survey course in philosophy, Socrates, all of the philosophers, and so on. And I'm sorry to say I can't tell you much of what occurred in the class. I didn't have the wit to take extensive notes. I didn't have the wit to bring a tape recorder to class. I didn't record these pearls of wisdom that fell from the lips of this marvelous man. In fact, I remember almost nothing that conspired between the class and Dr. King. But I do remember one day, he and I were walking across the beautiful Morehouse College campus, and I turned to him and I said, Doc, his friends called him Doc. I said, Doc, how are you doing? He said, Julian, I'm not doing well. He said, unemployment is high, racism is everywhere, sexism seems immovable. He said, I feel awful. He said, I have a nightmare. I said, no, Doc, turn that around. Try, I have a dream. I feel doubt. Anyway, let me proceed. About 2 weeks ago, I was in Minneapolis, where I saw a new play called Appomattox. It featured events over two important years of American history, 1865 and 1965, demonstrating that things had not changed a great deal in those two years. Specifically, in 1965, African Americans remained unable to be full citizens of the United States. It was, of course, relevant to today, for some Americans still have not decided if our just reelected president has the birthright of citizenship or whether people of color ought to be allowed to participate in all the rituals of democracy, including voting. This is an echo of the message that has radiated throughout our history since the Civil War. Black people do not belong in American political society and have no business wielding power over white people. Paradoxically, Barack Obama's victory in 2008 convinced many that all racial barriers and restrictions had been vanquished and we had entered a racial nirvana across the land. This was one of the many unfair burdens placed on Obama's presidency. We knew that his victory did not herald a post-civil rights era America or mean that race had been vanquished. It could not eliminate structural inequity or racist attitude. Indeed, there's evidence that it fomented them. Obama is to the Tea Party as the moon is to werewolves. Now, those who say that race is history have it exactly backward. History is race. The word America, scrambled after all, spells I am race. And America is race, from its symbolism to its substance, from its founding by slaveholders to its rending by the Civil War, from Johnny Reb to Jim Crow, from the Ku Klux Klan to Katrina, from Emmett Till to Trayvon Martin. This is the second year of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War, the war that claimed more American lives than all other wars combined in our nation's history. That it is occurring during the presidency of the first black person to hold the country's highest office is only one of many ironies that abound. When the Civil War ended, Southerners viewed the Republicans as an abolitionist party. Today, they embrace it as the white people's party. Then, opponents regarded Lincoln's election as intolerable. Today, they feel the same way about President Obama's. Having declared war to preserve slavery, in the war's aftermath, the traitor states denied having done so. Like today's right-wingers, they claimed their disaffection was rooted in respect for states' rights. Texas Governor Rick Perry has such respect for states' rights that he suggested his state might secede from the Union. Governor Perry no doubt influenced County Judge Tom Head, the highest elected official in Lubbock, Texas, who said recently about President Obama, "He's going to try to hand over our sovereignty of the United States to the UN, okay? What's going to happen when that happens? I'm thinking worst-case scenario. Civil unrest, civil disobedience, civil war, maybe. And we're not just talking a few riots here and demonstrations. We're talking Lexington, Concord, take up arms, and get rid of the guy." These are the same people who question Obama's citizenship. These birthers, whom we used to know as birchers, have more in common with Confederates than they do with patriots. Both our response to the nation's first black president and the response to the Civil War's anniversary confirm we are still a country at war with itself. But we're not the same country. We've gone from civil war to civil rights. In 1961, when the nation observed the Civil War centennial, the civil rights movement was gaining momentum, as was Dr. Martin Luther King. It was only 6 years earlier, during the Montgomery bus boycott, that King had been introduced to the nation and the world. He was then only 26 years old. At that early age, and at that early stage in the boycott, he understood how historic it would be. 4 days after Rosa Parks stood up for justice by sitting down, the boycott began. That evening, at the first mass meeting, Dr. King declared, "When the history books are written in the future, somebody will have to say, there lived a race of people, a black people, who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and thereby they injected a new meaning into the veins of history and civilization." In 1963 alone, the year that King, fresh from the battlefields of Birmingham, told the nation of his dream at the March on Washington, there were more than 10,000 anti-racist demonstrations. The result was the enactment of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the most sweeping civil rights legislation before or since, and one of Congress' finest hour. We look back on the years between Montgomery in 1955 and the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 with some pride. Those were the days when politicians of both parties supported the struggle for civil rights. Now they struggle to be civil. Those were the days when banks loaned money to people, not like today when the people loan money to the banks. Those were the days we were powered by our values and not valued for our power. Those were the days when good music was popular and when popular music was good. Those were the days when the president picked the Supreme Court and not the other way around. Those were the days when we had a war on poverty and not a war on the poor. Those were the days when the news media really was fair and balanced and not just mouthpieces for the misinformed. But those were not the good old days. In those days, the law, the courts, the schools, almost every institution favored whites. This was white supremacy. When the Supreme Court announced in May of 1955, in the second of two Brown decisions, that the white South could make hay slowly in dismantling segregated schools, I was 1 year older than Emmett Till. His murder 3 months after the second Brown decision was more immediate to me than the court's pronouncements had been. We were nearly the same age when he was killed in Money, Mississippi, for whistling at a white woman. His death terrified me. But in the fall of 1957, a group of black teenagers encouraged me to put that fear aside. These young people, the 9 young women and men who integrated Little Rock Central High School, set a high standard of grace and courage under fire as they dared the mobs who surrounded their school. Here I thought, this is what I can be if ever the chance comes my way. The chance to test and prove myself did come my way in 1960, as it came to thousands of other black high school and college students across the South in a mobilization of young black people not duplicated ever before or since. First through the sit-ins, then in freedom rides, then in voter registration and political organizing drives in the rural South, we joined an own movement against white supremacy that had deep, strong roots. Martin King was the most famous, best known of all the modern movement's personalities, but this was a people's movement. It produced leaders of its own. It relied not on the noted, but on the nameless, not on the famous, but on the faceless. It didn't wait for commands from afar to begin a campaign against injustice. It saw wrong and acted against it. It saw evil and it brought it down. Many of us now stand in reflection of that earlier movement's successes, including the election of Barack Obama. We're confused about what the next steps ought to be. The task ahead is enormous, equal to, if not greater, than the job already done. Looking back on that movement from today, we now see a very different view of the events and personalities of that period. Instead of the towering figures of Kings and Kennedy standing alone, we now see an army of anonymous women and men. Instead of famous orations made to multitudes, we now see the planning and the work that preceded the triumphant speech. And instead of a series of well-publicized marches and protests, we now also see long organizing campaigns and brave and lonely soldiers often working in near solitude. Instead of prayerful petitions for government's deliverance, we now see aggressive demands and the ethic of self-reliance and self-help. We now realize our view of the movement's goals was narrow too. Seeking more than the removal of racial segregation, that movement did not want to be integrated into a burning house. Rather, it wanted to build a better house for everyone. It marched on Washington for freedom and jobs, not for abstract freedom alone. And instead of a sudden and unanticipated upsurge in black activism in Montgomery in 1955, we now see a long and unceasing history of aggressive challenges to white supremacy that began as long ago as slavery time. And instead of a movement that ended in 1968 with the death of Dr. King, we now see continued movement stretching from the ancient past until this moment, with differing methods and techniques, whose central goal has always been the elimination of structures based on race. I want to talk about the organization I helped to start and then work with for several years, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, or SNCC. This organization was remembered by President John F. Kennedy. You can hear him on the White House tapes in the middle of the Birmingham movement when he's told that SNCC engaged in some activity in Birmingham the night before. President Kennedy said, and we're so proud of this, he said, they're sons of bitches, aren't they? This movement was founded in Raleigh in North Carolina in 1960 by Southern student protesters engaged in sit-in demonstrations against lunch counter segregation. Within a year, the organization evolved from a coordinating committee to a hands-on organization helping local leadership in rural and small-town communities across the South participate in a variety of protest and political and economic organizing campaigns, setting SNCC apart from the civil rights mainstream of the 1960s. Its members, youth, and independents enabled it to remain close to grassroots currents that rapidly escalated the Southern movement from sit-ins to freedom rides to voter rides to political organizing. By 1965, SNCC fielded the largest staff of any civil rights organization operating in the South. It had organized nonviolent direct action against segregated facilities and voter registration projects in Alabama, Arkansas, Maryland, Missouri, Louisiana, Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Illinois, North and South Carolina, Georgia, Texas, and Mississippi. It had built 2 independent political parties. It had organized labor unions and agricultural cooperatives. It gave the movement for women's liberation new energy. It inspired and trained the activists who began the New Left. It helped expand the limits of political debate within black America, and it broadened the focus of the civil rights movement. Unlike mainstream civil rights groups, which sought integration of blacks into the existing order, SNCC sought structural changes in American society itself. In 1960, and even today, the dominant organization fighting for civil rights was the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP. Then its preferred method was litigation. It had achieved its greatest victory in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education, outlawing segregation in public schools. The NAACP lobbied Congress and President to adopt anti-segregation measures. Its local branches were often the main civil rights outpost in many communities. The NAACP and similar groups and many individuals fought against a tripartite system of racial domination, which whites had solidified over time. The system protected the privileges of white society and generated tremendous human suffering for blacks. In the cities and rural areas of the South, blacks were controlled economically, politically, and personally, relegated to the worst jobs, prevented often by force and terror from free participation in the political process, denied due process of law and personal freedoms all whites routinely enjoyed. Ironically, a consequence of the segregation system was the development in close-knit communities of institutions, churches, schools, and organizations which nurtured and encouraged the fight against white supremacy. The student movement's goals were described to the Democratic Convention's Platform Committee in 1960 by SNCC's first chair, Marion Barry, as seeking a community in which man can realize the full meaning of self, which demands open relationships with others. Barry declared that Southern students wanted an end to racial discrimination in housing, education, employment, and voting. SNCC's goals were similarly broadly described by Executive Secretary James Forman in 1961 as working full-time against the whole value system of the country and by working toward revolution. In 1963, as a program of developing, building, and strengthening indigenous leadership, and by third SNCC Chair John Lewis at the 1963 March on Washington, as building a serious revolution against American politics dominated by politicians who build their careers on immoral compromises and ally themselves with open forms of political, economic, and social exploitation. SNCC pioneered first-time races for blacks in the 1960s Deep South, added foreign policy demands to the black political agenda, and broadened the acceptable limits of political discourse. SNCC was in the vanguard in demonstrating that independent black politics could be successful. Its early attempts to use black candidates to raise issues and races where success was unlikely expanded the political horizon. SNCC's development of independent political parties mirrored the philosophy that political form must follow function, and that non-hierarchical organizations were essential to counter the growth of personality cults and self-reinforcing leadership. For much of its early history, SNCC battled against the fear which had kept Southern rural blacks from aggressively organizing and acting in their own behalf. It strengthened or built aggressive, locally led movements in the communities where it works. While organizing grassroots registration drives, SNCC workers offered themselves as a protective barrier between private and state-sponsored terror and the local communities where SNCC staffers lived and worked. The rural South SNCC entered in 1961 had a long history of civil rights activism. In many issues, however, SNCC staffers were the first paid civil rights workers to base themselves in isolated rural communities, daring, as it reported then, to take the message of freedom into areas where the bigger civil rights organizations feared to tread. SNCC workers were more numerous and less transient than those from other civil rights organizations, and their method of organization was different as well. The NAACP was outlawed in Alabama in 1956 and did not begin operating there again until 1964, although NAACP activists continued under other sponsorship. In 1962, the NAACP had one field secretary each in South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi, and a regional staff headquartered in Atlanta. One historian wrote of Dr. King's organization, SCLC has had to adopt a strategy of hit and run, striking one target at a time. SCLC's willingness to run as well as hit provoked consistent criticism from SNCC, which organized the same communities for years rather than months. SNCC mobilized, someone said. SNCC organized. By August, SNCC had projects and permanent staff in a dozen Mississippi communities, in Selma, Alabama, Albany, Georgia, Danville, Virginia, and Pine Bluff, Arkansas. There were 12 workers in the Atlanta headquarters, 60 field secretaries, and 121 full-time volunteers. Typically, SNCC began campaigns by researching the political and economic history of a target community. Field workers were supplied with detailed information on a community's economic and financial power structure, tracing corporate relationships from local bankers and business leadership in a local white citizen council to the largest American banks and corporations. Other research provided the economic and political status of a state's black population. SNCC organizers spent their first weeks in a new community, meeting local leadership, formulating them with an action plan for more aggressive registration efforts, and recruiting new activists through informal conversation, house-to-house canvassing, and regular mass meetings. Register rural blacks, a SNCC worker wrote, would greatly liberate American politics as a whole. At the very least, these new voters would defeat the powerful, hidebound Southern Democrats who are holding the reins of Congress and the Senate on the basis of being elected year after year from districts where black citizens were denied the franchise. SNCC and other organizations fought white terror and helped create a willingness to risk danger by registering to vote. SNCC's broader definition of the civil rights movement's purposes was evident from its beginning. A report from the conference concluded with a warning about America's false preoccupations in 1960. Civil defense and economic power alone will not ensure the continuation of democracy, it said. Democracy itself demands the great intangible strength of the people, able to unite in a common endeavor because they are granted human dignity. Another recommendation noted, students have a natural claim to leadership in this period. They have pioneered in nonviolent direct action. Now we can show we understand the political implications of our movement that goes far beyond lunch counters. We're convinced of the necessity of all local areas joining in the campaign to secure the right to vote. Mississippi, the most resistant state, became a laboratory for SNCC's unique method of organizing. SNCC's work began in southwestern Mississippi in 1961, but when its workers were driven from the area by violence, state suppression, and federal indifference, the organization regrouped in Jackson and the Mississippi Delta counties in early 62. Earlier in 1961, SNCC's Nashville affiliate had continued the freedom rides when Alabama violence threatened to bring them to a halt. After they were released from Parchment Penitentiary, many jail riders had joined the McComb movement. Several became part of the organizing cadre in the Mississippi movement that followed. Thank you. Unencumbered by allegiances to the National Democratic Party, which frequently constrained other older organizations, SNCC encouraged two black candidates to run for Congress. They ran to shake loose the fear among Mississippi blacks, and through their progressive platforms, gave their intended constituents an expanded notion of what meaning politics might have in their lives. To demonstrate that disenfranchised Mississippi blacks did want to vote, SNCC mounted a Freedom Vote campaign in November of 1963. Over 80,000 blacks cast votes in a mock election for governor and lieutenant governor. 100 northern white students worked in this campaign, attracting attention from Department of Justice and national media as black registration workers had never done, paving the way for the Freedom Summer campaign in 1964. Freedom Summer brought 1,000 mostly white volunteers to Mississippi for the summer of 64. They helped build a new political party SNCC had organized, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. They registered voters and staffed 28 freedom schools intended by their designer to provide an education which will make it possible for them to challenge the myths of our society, to perceive more clearly its realities, and to find alternatives and ultimately new directions for action. Over the next several years, SNCC-backed candidates for Congress ran in Albany, Georgia, Selma, Alabama, Danville, Virginia, and Enfield, North Carolina. SNCC helped candidates for Agricultural Stabilization and Conservation Service boards in Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, North Carolina, and Mississippi, aided school board candidates in Arkansas in 1965, and worked toward solving the economic problems of the Southern Negro by organizing the Mississippi Freedom Labor Union and the Poor People's Corporation and mounting economic boycotts against discriminatory merchants. Among SNCC's contributions to electoral politics were the formation of two political parties and the conception and implementation of my successful campaigns for the Georgia legislature. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenged the seating of the all-white delegation from Mississippi at the 1964 Democratic Convention, and in 1965 challenged the seating of Mississippi's congressional delegation in Washington. The convention challenge ended in failure when pressure from Lyndon Johnson erased promised support from party liberals. An offer was made and rejected of two convention seats to be filled by the National Party, not by the Freedom Democrats. Freedom Democrat leader Fannie Lou Hamer declared, "We didn't come for no two seats when all of us is tired." Each challenge served as an object lesson for strengthening black political independence, and the organizing and lobbying efforts for each laid the groundwork for congressional passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In 1965, the McComb MFDP branch became the first black political organization to express opposition to the war in Vietnam. State MFD officials not only refused to repudiate the McComb statement, they reprinted it in the state MFDP newsletter, giving it wider circulation and laying the groundwork for future black opponents of the war. The MFDP's legal efforts against white resistance to political equality proved important to black political efforts across the South. The MFDP was not the only organization SNCC helped build, and not the only one that survived the demise of the parent. In 1964, SNCC encouraged a group of progressive New York health professionals to form a group to provide health care to workers in the Freedom Summer campaign. Most were veterans of past attempts to organize physicians to push for integration of the American Medical Association's segregated Southern affiliates and of sporadic attempts to win support for national health insurance. They called their new organization the Medical Committee for Human Rights. The mid-60s were a turning point in the Southern human rights struggle. And the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 accomplished the immediate goals of many in the movement. Northern urban riots in the late 60s made the nation and Southern civil rights workers aware that victories at lunch counters and ballot boxes meant little to blacks locked in Northern ghettos. SNCC had long believed its work ought to be expanded to larger cities in the South and outside the region. Executive committee minutes from December 1963 quote James Forman as asserting, SNCC is going to have to go into poor sections of large cities to work. My campaign for the Georgia House of Representatives in 1965 was an attempt to take the techniques SNCC had learned in the rural South into an urban setting and to carry forward SNCC's beliefs that grassroots politics could provide answers to problems faced by America's urban blacks. In keeping with SNCC's style, a platform was developed in consultation with the voters. The campaign supported a minimum wage of $2 an hour, repeal of the right to work law, and abolition of the death penalty. When the legislature twice rejected me, objecting to my support of SNCC's anti-war position, the resulting two campaigns gave SNCC a chance to successfully test its critique of American imperialism at the ballot box. In 1966 in Alabama, SNCC helped create a black political party called the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, an independent political party which would prove to be a factor in Alabama politics for years to come. The party was formed in reaction to the racism of local and state Democratic parties. Like the MFDP, the new party was open to whites, but no whites in Lowndes County would participate in a black-dominated political effort. Concurrently with the organizing efforts of the MFDP and the Lowndes County Freedom Organization, the Bond Campaign, SNCC was reassessing its concentration on the South. Projects were established in Washington, D.C. to fight for home rule, in Columbus, Ohio, where a community foundation was organized, in New York City.